"You know where the residence is?" I ask. She shakes her head. "If I did, I'd take you there myself. They've got equipment inside to check for radiation and electronic trackers. They've studied you. We'll be on our own."
"Lovely."
"But this isn't about tactics. No short-term gain here. My big play was coming out to the rim knowing I had leverage the Sovereign doesn't. That leverage will keep my head on my shoulders better than anyone's honor. Yet, I've been wrong before. So I double-check and listen now. Do the rules governing treatment of guests extend to Reds? Several asks. Or just Golds? That's what we need to know. I glance back at Vila. It's a fair point. If he kills you, he kills me, Mustang says. I'm not leaving your side, and if he does that, my men turn against him. The Telemannuses turn against him. Even Lorne's daughter-in-law will turn against him. That's nearly a third of his navy. It's a blood feud he can't afford. Seffi, what do you think? She closes her eyes so her blue tattoos can see the spirits of this waste.
Go.
Give us 6 hours, Evro. If we're not back by then, wank off in the bushes. Lay waste. Can do. He bumps my fist with his and winks. Happy diplomacy, kids. He keeps his fist out for Mustang. You too, horsey. We're in this shit together, eh? She happily bumps his knuckles with her own. Bloody damn right. Chapter 41. The Moon Lord. The home of the most powerful man in the Galilean moons is a simple, wandering place of little gardens and quiet nooks. Set in the shadow of a dormant volcano, it looks out over a yellow plain that stretches to the horizon, where another volcano smolders and magma creeps westward. We sat down in a small, covered hangar in the side of a rock formation, one of only two ships. The other, a sleek, black racing craft, Orion would die to fly, next to a row of several dust-covered hover bikes. No one comes to service our vessel as we disembark and approach the home along a white stone walkway set into the sulphur chalk. It curves around to the side of the home, the entirety of the small property enclosed by a discreet pulse bubble. Our escorts are at ease on the property. They fly in ahead of us through the iron gate that leads to the grass courtyard into the home, removing their dust-caked skipper boots and setting them just inside the entryway beside a pair of black military boots. Mustang and I exchange a glance, then remove our own. It takes me the longest to remove my bulky grav boots, each weighing nearly 9 kilos and having 3 parallel latches around the boot that locks my legs in. It's oddly comforting to feel the grass between my toes. I'm conscious of the stink of my feet. Odd seeing the boots of a dozen enemies stacked by the door, like I've walked in on something very private. "Please wait here," Vila says to me. "Virginia, Romulus wishes to speak with you alone first." "I'll scream if I'm in danger," I say with a grin when Mustang hesitates. She winks and leaves to follow Vila, who noticed the subtlety of the exchange. I feel there's little the older woman misses, even less that she doesn't judge. I'm left alone in the garden, with the song of a wind chime hanging from a tree above. The courtyard garden is an even rectangle, maybe 30 paces wide, 10 deep from the front gate to the small white steps that lead into the home's front entrance. The white plaster walls are smooth and covered with thin creeping vines that wander into the home. Little orange flowers erupt from the vines and fill the air with a woodsy, burning scent. The house rambles, rooms and gardens unfolding out from each other. There is no roof to the house, but there's little reason for one. The pulse bubble seals off the property from the weather outside. They make their own rain here. Little misters drip water from the morning's watering of the small citrus trees, whose roots crack the bottom of the white stone fountain in the center of the garden. A little glance at a place like this was what led my wife to the gallows. How strange a journey she'd think this was. But also, in a way, how marvelous.
"You can eat a tangerine if you like,"
a small voice says behind me.
"Father won't mind."
I turn to find a child standing by another gate that leads off from the main courtyard to a path that winds around the left of the house. She might be 8 years old. She holds a small shovel in her hands, and the knees of her pants are stained with dirt. Her hair is short-cropped and messy, her face pale, eyes a third again as large as any girl of Mars. You can see the tender length of her bones, like a fresh-born colt. There's a wildness in her. I've not met many gold children. Core, peerless families often guard them from the public eye, for fear of assassination, keeping them in private estates or schools. I've heard the Rim is different. They do not kill children here. But everyone likes to pretend that they don't kill children. "Hello," I say kindly. It's a fragile, awkward tone I haven't used since I saw my own nieces and nephews. I love children, but I feel so alien to them these days.
"You're the Martian, aren't you?"
she asks, impressed. "My name is Darrow," I reply with a nod. "What's yours?"
"I am Sarah Aura," she says proudly. "Were you really a Red?"
"I heard my father speaking," she explains.
"They think just because I don't have this..."
She runs a finger along her cheek in an imaginary scar.
"That I don't have ears."
She nods up to the vine-covered walls and smiles mischievously.
"Sometimes I climb."
"I still am a Red," I say. "It's not something I stop being."
"Oh, you don't look like one."
She must not watch Hollows if she doesn't know who I am. "Maybe it's not about what I look like," I suggest. "Maybe it's about what I do." Is that too clever a thing to say to a 6-year-old? Hell if I know. She makes a disgusted face, and I fear I've made a mistake. "Have you met many Reds, Sarah?" She shakes her head. "I've only seen them in my studies. Father says it's not proper to mingle." "Don't you have servants?" She giggles before she realizes I'm serious.
"Servants? But I haven't earned servants."
She taps her face again.
"Not yet."
It darkens my mood to think of this girl, running for her life through the woods of the Institute. Or will she be the one chasing?
"Nor will you ever earn them if you don't leave our guest alone, Serafina,"
a low, husky voice says from the main entry to the house. Romulus Aura leans against the doorframe of his home. He is a serene and violent man. My height, yet thinner, with a twice-broken nose. His right eye a third larger than mine, set in a narrow, wrathful face. His left eyelid is crossed with a scar. A smooth globe of blue and black marble stares out at me, in place of eyeball. His full lips are pinched, the top lip bearing 3 more scars. His dark gold hair is long, and held in a ponytail. Except for the old wounds, his skin is perfect porcelain. But it's how he seems, more than how he looks, that makes the man. I feel his steady way, his easy confidence, as if he's always been at the door, always known me. It's startling how much I like him from the moment he winks at his daughter, and also how much I want him to like me, despite the tyrant I know him to be.
"So, what do you make of our Martian?"
he asks his daughter.
He is thick, Serafina says. Larger than you, father.
But not as large as a Telemannus, I say.
She crosses her arms. Well, nothing is as large as a Telemannus.
I laugh. If only that were true. I knew a man who was nearly as large to me as I am to you.
No, Serafina says, eyes widening. An obsidian?
I nod. His name was Ragnar Valaris. He was stained. A prince of an obsidian tribe from the south pole of Mars. They call themselves the Valkyrie, and they are ruled by women who ride griffins. I look at Romulus. His sister is with me.
Who ride griffins? The notion dazzles the girl.
She's not yet gotten there in her studies.
Where is he now?
He died, and we fired him toward the sun as we came to visit your father.
Oh, I'm sorry,
she says, with the blind kindness it seems only children still have.
Is that why you looked so sad?
I flinch, not knowing it was so obvious. Romulus notices and spares me from answering. Serafina, your uncle was looking for you. The tomatoes won't plant themselves, will they? Serafina dips her head and gives me a farewell wave, before departing back down the path. I watch her disappear, and belatedly realize that my child would be her age now. Did you arrange that? I ask Romulus. He steps into the garden. Would you believe me if I said no? I don't believe much from anyone these days. That'll keep you breathing, but not happy. He says seriously, voice having the clipped staccato delivery of a man raised in gladiatorial academies. There's no affectations here, no purring insults or games. It's a refreshing, if estranging, directness. This was my father's refuge, and his father's before mine, Romulus says, gesturing for me to take a seat on one of the stone benches. I thought it a fitting place to discuss the future of my family. He plucks a tangerine from the tree and sits on an opposite bench. And yours? It seems a strange amount of effort to expend, I say. What do you mean? The trees, the dirt, the grass, the water. None of it belongs here. And the man was never meant to tame fire. That's the beauty of it, he says challengingly. This moon is a hateful little horror, but through ingenuity, through will, we made it ours. Or are we just passing through? I ask. He wags a finger at me. You've never been credited for being wise. Not wise, I correct. I've been humbled, and it's a sobering thing. The box was real? Romulus asks. We've heard rumors this last month. It was real. Indecorous, he says in contempt. But it speaks to the quality of your enemy. His daughter left little muddy footprints on the stone path. She didn't know who I was. Romulus concentrates on peeling the tangerine in delicate little ribbons. He's pleased, I noticed, about his daughter. No child in my family watches hollows before the age of 12. We all have nature and nurture to shape us. She can watch other people's opinions when she has opinions of her own, and no sooner. We're not digital creatures. We're flesh and blood. Better she learns that before the world finds her. Is that why there are no servants here? There are servants, but I don't need them seeing you today. And they aren't hers. What kind of parent would want their children to have servants? He asks, disgusted by the idea. The moment a child thinks it is entitled to anything, they think they deserve everything. Why do you think the core is such a Babylon? Because it's never been told no. Look at the institutes you attended. Sexual slavery, murder, cannibalism of fellow golds. He shakes his head. Barbaric. It's not what the ancestors intended. But the core worlders are so desensitized to violence, they've forgotten it's to have purpose. Violence is a tool. It is meant to shock, to change. Instead, they normalize and celebrate it, and create a culture of exploitation where they are so entitled to sex and power that when they are told no, they pull a sword and do as they like. Just as they've done to your people, I say. Just as they've done to my people, he repeats. Just as we do to yours. He finishes peeling the tangerine, only now it feels more like a scalping. He tears the meat of it gruesomely in half and tosses one part to me. I won't romanticize what I am, or excuse the subjugation of your people. What we do to them is cruel, but it is necessary. Mustang told me on our journey here that he uses a stone from the Roman Forum itself as a pillow. He is not a kind person, not to his enemies at least, which I am, regardless of his hospitality. It's hard for me to speak to you as if you were not a tyrant, I say. You sit here and think you are more civilized than Luna because you obey your creed of honor, because you show restraint. I gesture to the simple house. But you're not more civilized, I say. You're just more disciplined. Isn't that civilization? Order? Denying animal impulse for stability? He eats his fruit in measured bites. I set mine on the stone. No, it's not. But I'm not here to debate philosophy or politics. Thank Jove. I doubt we'd agree upon much. He watches me carefully. I'm here to discuss what we both know best. War. Our ugly old friend. He glances once at the door to the house to make sure we're alone. But before we move to that sphere, may I ask you a question of personal note? If you must. You are aware my father and daughter died at your triumph on Mars. I am. In a way, it's what began all this. Did you see it happen? I did. Was it as they say? I wouldn't presume to know who they are or what they say. They say that Antonia Au Severus Julii stepped on my daughter's skull till it caved in. My wife and I wish to know if it is true. It's what we were told by one of the few who managed to escape. Yes, I say. It is true. The tangerine drips in his fingers, forgotten. Did she suffer? I hardly remember seeing the girl in the moment, but I've dreamed of the night 100 times, enough to wish my memory was a weaker thing. The plain-faced girl wore a grey dress with a brooch of the lightning dragon. She tried to run around the fountain, but Vixus slashed the back of her hamstrings as she walked past. She crawled and wept on the ground until Antonia finished her off. She suffered. For several minutes. Did she weep? Yes. But she did not beg. Romulus watches out the iron gate as sulfur dust devils dance across the barren plain beneath his quiet home. I know his pain. The horrible, crushing sadness of loving something gentle, only to see it ripped apart by the hard world. His girl grew here, loved, protected, and then she went on an adventure and learned fear. Truth can be cruel, he says.
yet it is the only thing of value. I thank you for it. And I have a truth of my own. One I do not think you will like. You have another guest, I say. He's surprised. There's Boots at the door. Polished for a ship, not a planet. Makes the dust stick something awful. I'm not offended. I half expected it when you didn't meet me in the desert. You understand why I will not make a decision blindly or impetuously? I do. 2 months ago, I did not agree with Virginia's plan to negotiate for peace. She left of her own accord with the backing of those frightened by our losses. I believe in war only insofar as it is an effective tool of policy, and I did not believe we stood in a position of strength to gain anything from our war without achieving at least one or two victories. Peace was subjugation by another word. My logic was sound, our arms were not. We never made the victories. Imperator Fabii is effective. And the Corps, as much as I despise their culture, produces very good killers with very good logistical supply and support. We are fighting uphill against a giant. Now you are here, and I can achieve something with peace that I could not with war. So I must weigh my options. He means he can leverage my presence into suing the Sovereign for better terms than she would have given if the war had continued. It's boldly self-interested. I knew it was a risk when I set this course, but I'd hoped he'd be hot-blooded after a year of war with the woman and would want to pay her back. Apparently, Romulus Aura's blood runs a special kind of cold. Who did the Sovereign send? I ask. He leans back in amusement. Who do you think? Chapter 42. The Poet. Rogue Au Fabii sits at a stone table in an orchard along the side of the house, finishing a dessert of elderberry cheesecake and coffee. Smoke from a brooding dwarf volcano twirls up into the twilight horizon with the same indolence as the steam from his porcelain saucer. He turns from watching the smoke to see us enter. He is striking in his black and gold uniform, lean like a strand of golden summer wheat, with high cheekbones and warm eyes. But his face is distant and unyielding. By now he could drape a dozen battle glories across his chest, but his vanity is so deep that he thinks affectation a sign of boorish decadence. The pyramid of the society, given flight with imperator wings on either side, marks each shoulder. A gold skull with a crown burdens his breast, the sigil of the Ash Lord's warrant. Roke sets the saucer down delicately, dabs his lips with the corner of his napkin, and rises to his bare feet. "Darrow, it's been an age," he says, with such mannered grace that I could almost convince myself that we were old friends, reuniting after a long absence. "But I will not let myself feel anything for this man. I cannot let him have forgiveness. Victra almost died because of him. Fitchner did. Lorne did. And how many more would have, had I not let Severo leave the party early to seek his father?" "Imperator Fabii," I reply evenly. But behind my distant welcome is an aching heart. There's not a hint of sorrow on his face, however. I want there to be. And knowing that, I know I still feel for the man. He is a soldier of his people. I'm a soldier of mine. He is not the evil of his story. He is the hero who unmasked the Reaper, who smashed the Augustus Telemannus fleet at the Battle of Deimos the night after my capture. He does not do these things for himself.
He lives for something as noble as I. His people. His only sin is in loving them too much, as is his way. Mustang watches me worriedly, knowing all I must feel. She asked me about him on the journey from Mars. I told her that he was nothing to me. But we both know that isn't true. She's with me now, anchoring me among these predators. Without her, I could face my enemies, but I would not hold on to so much of myself. I would be darker, more wrathful. I count my blessings that I have people like her, to which I can tether my spirit. Otherwise, I fear it would run away from me. I can't say it's a pleasure to see you again, Roke, she says, taking the attention away from me. Though I am surprised the Sovereign didn't send a politico to treat with us.
She did,
Roke says. And you returned Moira as a corpse. The Sovereign was deeply wounded by that, but she has faith in my arms and judgment, just as I have faith in the hospitality of Romulus. Thank you for the meal, by the by, he says to our host. Our commissary is woefully militaristic, as you can imagine. The benefit of earning a breadbasket, Romulus says. Siege is never a hungry affair. He gestures for us to take our seats. Mustang and I take the two facing Roke as Romulus sits at the head of the table. Two other chairs to the right and left of him are filled with the Arch-Governor of Titan and an old, crooked woman I don't know. She wears the wings of Imperator. Roke watches me. It does please me, Dara, knowing you're finally participating in the war you began. Darrow isn't responsible for this war, Mustang says. Your Sovereign is. For instilling order? Roke asks. For obeying the compact? Oh, that's fresh. I know her a bit better than you, poet. The crone is a nasty, covetous creature. Do you think it was Arja's idea to kill Quinn? She waits for an answer. None comes. It was Octavia's. She told her to do it through the comm in her ear. Quinn died because of Darrow, Roke says. No one else. The Jackal bragged to me that he killed Quinn, I say. Did you know that? Roke is unimpressed with my claim. If he'd let her be, she would have lived. He killed her in the back of the ship while the rest of us fought for our lives.
Liar.
I shake my head. Sorry, but that guilt you feel in your skinny little gut, that's gonna stick around. Because it's the truth. You made me a mass murderer against my own people, Roke says. My debt to my Sovereign and the Society for my part in the Bellona-Augustus War is not yet paid. Millions lost their lives in the Siege of Mars. Millions who need not have died if I had seen through the ruse and done my duty to my people. His voice quavers. I know the lost look in his eyes. I've seen it in my own in the mirror as I wake from a nightmare and stare at myself in the pale bathroom light of that same stateroom on Luna. All those millions cry to him in the darkness, asking him why. He continues. What I cannot understand, Virginia, is why you abandoned the talks on Phobos. Talks which would have healed the wounds that divide gold and permit us to focus on our true enemy. He looks at me heavily. This man wanted your father to die. He desires nothing but the destruction of our people. Pax died for his lie. Your father died because of his schemes. He is using your heart against you. Spare me, Mustang snorts contemptuously. I'm trying to. Don't talk down to me, poet. You're the weeping sort here, not me.
This isn't about love. This is about what is right. That has nothing to do with emotion. It has to do with justice, which rests upon facts.
The Moon Lords shift uncomfortably at the notion of justice. She jerks her head in their direction.
They know I believe in Rim independence. And they know I'm a reformer. And they know I'm intelligent enough not to conflate the two or to confuse my emotions with my beliefs. Unlike you. So since your rhetorical plays here are going to fall on deaf ears, shall we spare ourselves the indignity of verbal jousting and make our propositions, so we can end this war one way or another?
Roke glowers at her. Romulus smiles slightly. Do you have anything to add, Darrow?
I believe Mustang covered it quite thoroughly.
Very well, Romulus replies. Then I shall say my piece and let you say yours. You are both my enemies. One has plagued me with workers' strikes, anti-government propaganda, insurrection. The other with war and siege. Yet here, on the fringe of the darkness, away from both your sources of power, you need me, and my ships, and my legions. You see the irony? My lone question is this. Who can give me more in return?
He looks first to Roke. Imperator, please begin.
Honorable lords, my sovereign mourns this conflict between our people, as do I. It spawned from the seed sown in previous disputes, but it can end now, as Rim and Kor remember that there is a greater, more pernicious evil than political squabbling and debate over taxes and representation, and that is the evil of democracy. That noble lie, that all men are created equal. You've seen it tear Mars apart. Adrius our Augustus has nobly fought the battle there on behalf of the society.
Nobly? Romulus asks.
Effectively. But still the contagion has spread. Now is our best chance to destroy it before it can claim a victory from which we may never be able to recover. Despite our differences, our ancestors all fell upon Earth in the conquering. In remembrance of that, the Sovereign is willing to cease all hostilities. She requests the aid of your legions and Armada in destroying the Red Menace that seeks to destroy both Rim and Kor. In return, after the war, she will remove the societal garrison from Jupiter, but not Saturn or Uranus.
The Arch-Governor of Titan snorts contemptuously. She will enter into talks in good faith regarding the reduction of taxes and Rim export tariffs. She will grant you the same licenses for belt mining which core companies currently hold, and she will accept your proposal for equal representation in the Senate.
And the reformation of the sovereign election process? Romulus asks. She was never meant to be an empress. She's an elected official.
She will revise the election process after the new senators have been appointed. Additionally, the Olympic Knights will be appointed by the vote of the arch-governors, not by order of the sovereign. As you requested.
Mustang tilts her head back and laughs one hard note.
I'm sorry. Call me skeptical. But what you're saying, Roke, is that the Sovereign will say yes to everything Romulus might want until she's back in a position to say no.
She blows air out of her nose comically.
Trust me, my friends. My family well knows the sting of the Sovereign's promises.
And what of Antonia Au Julii?
Romulus asks,
noting Mustang's skepticism. Will you deliver her to our justice for the murder of my daughter and father?
I will.
Romulus is pleased by the terms, and moved by Rogue's comments about the Red Menace. It doesn't help that his promises seem very plausible. Practical. Not promising too much or too little. All I can do to combat them is to embrace the fact that I offer them a fantasy. And a dangerous one at that. Romulus looks to me, waiting. Color notwithstanding, you and I have a common bond. The Sovereign is a politician. I am a man of the sword. I deal in angles and metal, like you. That is my lifeblood, my entire purpose for being. Look how I rose in your ranks without being one of you. Look how I took Mars, the most successful iron reign in centuries. I lean forward. Lords, I will give you the independence you deserve. Not half-measured, not transient, permanent independence from Luna. No taxes, no 20 years of service to the Corps for your greys and obsidians. No orders from the Babylon that the Corps has become. A bold promise, Romulus says, showing the depth of his character by bearing the insult he must feel at a red promising to deliver him his independence. An outlandish promise, Rogue says. Darrow is only who he is because of who is around him. Agreed, Mustang says cheerily. And I still have everyone around me, Rogue. Who do you have? No one, Mustang answers. Just dear old Antonia, who has become my brother's quisling. The words hit home with Roke and Romulus. I return to addressing the Moon Lords. You have the greatest dockyard the worlds have ever seen. But you started your war too quickly. Without enough ships, without enough fuel. Thinking the Sovereign would not be able to send a fleet here so quickly. You were wrong. But the Sovereign has made a mistake as well. All her remaining fleets are in the Corps, defending moons and worlds against Orion. But Orion is not in the Corps. She is with me. Her forces joined to the ships I stole from the Jackal to form the armada with which I will smash the Sword Armada from the sky. You don't have the ships for that, Broke says. You don't know what I have, I say. And you don't know where I hide it. How many ships does he have? Romulus asks Mustang.
Enough.
Roke would have you believe I'm a wildfire.
Do I look wild?
Not today, at least. Romulus, you have no interest in the Corps, just as I have no interest in the Rim. This is not my home. We are not enemies. My war is not against your race, but against the rulers of my home. Help us shatter the Sword Armada, and you will have your independence. Two birds with one stone. Even if I do not defeat the Sovereign in the Corps after we defeat the Poet here, even if I lose within the year, we will cause such damage that it will be a lifetime before Octavia can summon the ships, the money, the men, the commanders to cross the billion kilometers darkness again. The Moon Lords lean into my words. I may yet have them. Roke scoffs. Do you really think this self-styled liberator will abandon the low colors in the Rim? In the Galilean moons alone, over 150 million are enslaved. If I could free them, I would, I admit. But I cannot. I recognize that, and it breaks my heart, because they are my people. But every leader must sacrifice. This receives nods from the Goals. Even if I am the enemy, they can respect my loyalty to my people, and also the pain I must feel. It is odd having such veneration in the eyes of my enemies. I am not used to it. Roke also sees the nods.
I know this man better than any of you, he presses. I know him like a brother. And he is a liar. He would say whatever it took to break the bonds that bind us together.
Unlike the Sovereign, who never lies, I say lightly, drawing a few laughs. The Sovereign will honour her agreement, Roke insists. As she did with my father? Mustang asks scathingly. When she planned to kill him at the gala last year? I was her lancer, and she planned it right under my nose. And why? Because he did not agree with her politics. Imagine what she'd do to men who actually went to war with her.
Hear, hear,
the Arch-Governor of Titan says, rapping his knuckles on the table. And instead you would trust a terrorist and a turncoat? Roke asks. He has conspired to destroy our society for 6 years. His entire existence is deception. How could you trust him now? How could you think a red cares more for you than a gold? Roke shakes his head sadly. We are Oriat, my brothers and sisters. We are the order that protects mankind. Before us was a race intent on destroying the only home it had ever known. But then we brought peace. Do not let Darrow manipulate you into bringing back the dark age that came before. They will purge all the wonders we have made to fill their bellies and sate their lusts. We have a chance to stop him, here, now. We have a chance to unite once more, as we were always meant to, for our children. What world do you want them to inherit? Roke puts a hand over his heart. I am a man of Mars. I have no love for the core any more than you. The appetites of Luna have pillaged my planet long before I was born. That must change. And it will change. But not at the end of his sword. He would burn the house to fix a broken window. No, friends, that is not the way. To change for the better, we must look past the politics of the day and remember the spirit of our golden age. Oriat, united over all. The longer this plays, the more likely Roke will convince them of their patriotism. Mustang and I both know it, just as I knew I would have to sacrifice something in coming here. I'd hoped it would not be what I'm about to offer, but I know by the looks in the eyes of the Moon Lords that Roke's message has struck home. They fear an uprising. They fear me. It is the great dread of the Sons of Ares, the great mistake Severo made in releasing my carving and taking the Sons to a true war. In the shadows we could let them kill each other. We were just an idea. But Roke has made them think the thought that unites all masters who have ever been. What if the slaves take my property for their own? When my uncle gave me my sling blade, he said it would save my life for the price of a limb. Every miner is told that, so he knows from the first day he steps in the mine, the sacrifice is worth it. I make one now, for which I may never be forgiven. I will give you the Sons of Ares, I say quietly. No one hears me through Roke's continued speech, only Mustang. I will give you the Sons of Ares. I repeat more loudly. Quiet falls over the table. Romulus's chair creaks as he leans forward.
What do you mean?
I told you I have no interest in the rim. Now I will prove it. There are over 350 Sons of Ares cells throughout your territories, I say. We are your dock strikes. We are the sanitation sabotage, and the reason why Nessus's streets fill with shit. Even if you hand me over to the Sovereign today, the Sons will bleed you for 1,000 years. But I will give you every single Son of Ares cell in the rim. I will abandon the low colors here and take my crusade to the core, never coming through the asteroid belt as long as I live if you help me kill his bloody damn fleet. I stab a finger at Roke, who looks horrified.
That is insanity, Roke says,
noting the effect my words have had.
He's lying.
But I am not lying. I've given orders for the Sons of Ares cells to evacuate across the rim. Not many will make it out.
Thousands will be captured, tortured, killed. Thus is war and the peril of leadership.
Lords, the Imperator is asking you to bow, I reply. Aren't you tired of that? Of groveling to a throne 600 million kilometers from your home? They nod. The Sovereign says I am a threat to you. But who has bombed your cities? Who has slain 1 million of your people? Who kept your children hostage on Luna, slaughtered your father and daughter on Mars? Who burned an entire moon? Was it me? Was it my people? No. Your greatest enemy is the greed of the core, the burners of Rhea.
That was a different time, Roke protests. It was the same woman,
I snarl, and look to the Saturnian gold to Romulus's left, who pays rapt attention.
Who burned Rhea?
The Sovereign has forgotten, because her throne sits with its back toward the rim. But you see her glassy corpse every night in your skies.
Rhea was a mistake, Roke says,
falling into the pitfall that Mustang helped me prepare.
One that must never be repeated.
Never repeated? Mustang asks, springing the trap shut. She turns to Vila, who watches from the steps of the house with several other Ionian golds.
Vila, my friend, may I please have my data pad?
Don't play her game, Roke says.
My game? Mustang asks coyly.
My game is facts, Imperator.
Are those not welcome here, or is rhetoric alone permissible?
Personally, I trust no man who fears facts.
She looks back to Vila, amused by her own barbs. You can operate it for me, Vila. The password is L17L6363.
She grins at my surprise.
Vila looks to her brother.
She might send a message to Barker.
Deactivate my connection, Mustang says.
Romulus nods to Vila. She deactivates it.
Look in data folders, cache number 3, please.
She does. At first the quiet girl's eyes narrow, confused at what she's looking at. Then, as she reads, her lips curl back and the skin on her arms pucker with goosebumps. The rest of the small gathering watches her reaction with growing anxiety.
Illuminating, isn't it, Vila?
What is it? Romulus demands. Show us.
Vila glares hatefully at Roke, who is as confused as anyone, and walks the device to her brother. His face manages to remain impassive as he reads the data, fingers swiping through the files.
I use Cassius's information against his master now, turning his gift into an arrow aimed at her heart.
Mustang and I thought it would be better coming from her, however, lending the lie to the credibility of her friendship with Romulus.
Put it up, Romulus says, tossing the data pad to Vila.
What is this? Roke asks angrily. Romulus?
His words falter, as an image of asteroid S1988, part of the Charin subfamily of the Coronas family of asteroids in the Kuiper Belt between Mars and Jupiter, blossoms in the air. It rotates slowly over the table, the green stream of data beneath it spelling the Sovereign's doom. It's a series of falsified society communiques detailing the delivery of supplies to an asteroid without a base. The stream continues to roll, detailing high-level society directives for refueling at the asteroid. Then it shows the footage of the ship I sent away from the main fleet to investigate the asteroid as the rest of us journey to Jupiter. Reds float through the dark warehouse, the small jets on their suits silent in the vacuum, but their Geiger meters, which are synced to their helms, crackle at the amount of radiation in the place. A far greater amount of radiation than is present in the legal 5-megaton warheads, which are used in space combat. Romulus stares at Rogue.
If Raya was not to be repeated, then why did your fleet empty a nuclear weapons depot before coming to our orbit?
We did not visit the depot, Rogue says, still trying to process what he's seen and the implications of it. The evidence is compelling. All lies are better served with a hefty helping of the truth. The Sons of Ares pillaged it months ago. The information is falsified. He's operating off of the wrong information, which means the Sovereign has kept the Jackal's sedition tight to her chest. And now she pays for trusting so few. He's not prepared for this argument, and it shows.
So there is a depot?
Romulus asks. Rogue realizes how devastating the admission was.
Romulus frowns and continues. Imperator Fabii, why would there be a secret depot of nuclear weapons between here and Luna?
It's classified.
Surely you jest.
The Societal Navy is responsible for the security of...
If it was for security, then wouldn't it be nearer a base?
Romulus asks.
This is near the edge of the asteroid belt, on the path a fleet from Luna would use when Jupiter is in closest orbit to the Sun. As if it was a cache meant to be acquired by an imperator on the way to my home.
Romulus, I realize how this looks.
Do you, young Fabii? Because it looks as if you were considering annihilation to be an option against the people you call brother and sister.
This information is clearly falsified,
except the existence of the depot.
Yes, Rogue admits.
That exists. And the nuclear warheads? With that much radiation?
They're for security.
But the rest of it is a lie.
Yes.
So you didn't, in fact, come to my home with enough nuclear weapons to make our moons glass?
We did not, Rogue says. The only warheads we have aboard are for ship-to-ship combat. 5 megaton yield, max.
Romulus, on my honour, the same honour you had when you betrayed your friend?
Romulus gestures to me.
When you betrayed Honourable Lorne, my ally, Augustus, my father, Rivas? That honour by which you watched as my daughter's head was stomped in by a sociopathic matricide who takes orders from a sociopathic patricide?
Romulus.
No, Imperator Fabii. I do not believe you deserve the intimacy of using my given name any longer. You called Darrow a savage, a liar, but he came here wearing his heart on his sleeve. You came with the lies, hiding behind manners and breeding. Archgovernor Ra, you must listen. There's explanation if you will just...
Enough!
Romulus screams, surging to his feet and slamming his large hand on the table. Enough hypocrisy! Enough schemes! Enough lies, you snivelling core sycophant! He trembles, finally, with the rage. If you were not my guest, I would hurl my glove at you and cut your manhood away in the bleeding place. Your lost generation has forgotten what it means to be gold. You have forsaken your heritage, suckling at the tit of power. And why? For what? Those wings on your shoulders, Imperator.
He scoffs at the word.
You whelp. I
pity a world where you decide if a man like Lorne Au Arcus lives or dies. Did your parents never teach you?
They did not. Roke was raised by tutors, by books.
What is pride without honour? What is honour without truth? Honour is not what you say. It is not what you read. Romulus thumps his chest. Honour is what you do.
Then do not do this, Roke says. Your master did this, Romulus replies indifferently.
If she could not make us bow, she would make us burn. Again.
Mustang tries and fails to keep the smile from her face as Roke watches the Moon Lord slip through his fingers. A darkness enters his cultured voice, one which leaves my heart in tatters. To think that voice once defended me. Now he guards something far less loving. A society that cares nothing for him. I always wondered why Fichtner selected Roke for House Mars. Until his betrayal, I had known him to be only the most gentle soul. But now the Imperator shows his wrath.
Arch-Governor Ra, listen to me carefully, he says. You are mistaken in believing we came here with intent to destroy you. We came to preserve the society. Don't give in to Darrow's manipulation. You are better than that. Accept the Sovereign's terms, and we may have peace for another 1,000 years. But if you choose this path, if you renege on our armistice, there will be no quarter. Your fleet is ragged. Darrow's, wherever it hides, can be nothing more than a coalition of deserters in borrowed vessels. But we are the Sword Armada. We are the Iron Hand of the Legion and the Fury of the Society. Our ships will darken the lights of your worlds. You know what I can do. You do not have a commander to match me. And when your ships burn, the Knights of the Corps will pour into your cities at the head of flying columns and fill the air with ash enough to choke your children. If you betray your color, the compact, the society, which is what this will be, Ilium will burn. I will acquaint you with ruin. I will hunt down every person you have ever known, and I will exterminate their seed from the worlds. I will do so with a heavy heart, but I am a man of Mars, a man of war. So know my wrath will be unending. He extends a thin hand. The wolf of House Mars's mouth is open in a silent, hungry howl. Take my hand in kinship for the sake of your people and the sake of gold, or I will use it to build an age of peace upon the ashes of your house.
Romulus walks around the edge of the table so that he is facing Roke, the younger man's outstretched hand between them. Romulus draws his razor from where it is coiled on his hip. It rasps into rigid form, a blade etched with visions of Earth and of the conquering. His family is as old as Mustang's, as old as Octavia's. He uses that blade to slice open his hand and suck the scarlet blood from the wound, before drawing up and spitting it into Roke's face. This is a blood feud. If ever again we meet, you are mine, or I am yours, Fabii. If ever again we draw breath in the same room, one breath shall cease. It is a formal, cold declaration that requires one thing of Roke. He nods.
Vela, See the Imperator to his shuttle. He has a fleet to prepare for battle.
Romulus, you can't let him leave, Mustang says. He's too dangerous.
I agree, I say, but for another reason. I'd spare Rogue from this battle. I do not want his blood on my hands. Hold him prisoner until the battle is over, then release him unharmed.
This is my home, Romulus says. This is how we conduct ourselves. I promised him safe passage. He shall have it.
Roke dabs the blood and spit away with the same napkin he used for the cheesecake, and follows Vila away from the table toward the steps that lead back into the home. He pauses there before turning back to face us. I cannot say if he speaks to me or the golds gathered, but when he recites his last words, I know they are for the ages.
Brothers, sisters, till the last, woe that this has come to pass. By your grave I shall weep, for it was I who made you sleep.
Roke bows minutely. Thank you for the hospitality, Arch-Governor. I will see you shortly. As Roke leaves the assembly, Romulus instructs Vila to hold him until I am safely off Io.
Hail my Imperator Sempritus, he tells one of his lancers. I want them on Hollows in 20 minutes. We have a battle to plan. Darrow, if you would like to link in your Praetors.
But my mind is on Rogue. I may never see him again. Never have a chance to say so many things which swarm my chest now. But so, too, do I know what letting him go could mean for my people.
Go, Mustang says, reading my eyes.
I rise abruptly, excusing myself, and manage to catch Roke as he finishes tying his boots in the garden. Vila and several others are moving him towards the iron gate.
Roke!
He hesitates, something in my voice causing him to turn and watch me approach.
When did I lose you?
I ask.
When Quinn died, he says.
You planned to kill me, even when you thought I was a gold?
Gold, red, it doesn't matter. Your spirit is black. Quinn was good. Leah was good. And you used them. You are ruin, Darrow. You drain your friends of life, and leave them spent and wasted in your wake, convincing yourself each death is worth it. Each death brings you closer to justice. But history is littered with men like you. This society is not without fault, but the hierarchy, this world, it is the best man can afford.
And it's your right to decide that.
Yes, it is.
But beat me in space,
and it will be yours.
Chapter 43. Here again. Blood drips from Mustang's hand. The voices of children drift through the air.
My son, my daughter, now that you bleed, you shall know no fear.
A young virgin girl, with hair of white and feet bare on cold metal panels, walks through the lines of kneeling giants, carrying an iron dagger that drips with aureate blood.
No defeat.
Gold armor etched with deeds of their ancestors. The boy's cloak, innocent as snow.
Only victory.
She slices the already injured hand of Romulus Al-Ra, whose eyes are closed, his dragon armor white and smooth as ivory, as his other hand holds his eldest son's hand. The boy is no older than 17, only just having won his year at the Ganymede Institute. His eyes are flashing and wild for the day.
If only his intrepid young soul knew what waited on the other side of the hour. His older cousin kneels by his side, her hand on his knee. Her brother beside her. The family forming a chain across the bridge.
Your cowardice seeps from you.
Behind the girl, more children walk through the fold, carrying the four standards of gold. A scepter, a sword, and a scroll crowned with a laurel.
Your rage burns bright.
She holds up the dripping dagger before Kavax Au Telemanus and his youngest daughter, Thraxa, a wild-haired, freckle-faced, squat girl with her father's laugh and Pax's simple kindness.
Rise, children of Ilium, warriors of gold, and take with you your colour's might.
200 gold praetors and legates rise. Mustang and Romulus at their head, flanked by the Telemanuses and House Arcos. Mustang lifts up her hand and smears the blood upon her own face. 200 killers join her. But I do not. I watch from the corner with Sephi, as the combined officer corps of my gold allies honors their ancestors. Martian reformers, rim tyrants, old friends, old enemies, clutter the bridge of Mustang's flagship. The 200-year-old dreadnought, Deja Thoris.
The battle today is to decide the fate of our society. Whether we live under the rule of a tyrant, or whether we carve our own destiny.
Mustang catalogues the list of enemies for the day's hunt.
Roke Au Fabii, Scipia Au Folth, Antonia Au Severus Julii, Syriana Au Tarnus.
Thistle.
These are wanted lives.
I've been here before, witnessing this benediction, and I can't help but feel I will be here again. It has lost none of its luster. None of the grandeur that so sheathes this remarkable people. They go to death not for the veil, not for love, but for glory. We have never seen a race quite like them, nor will we again. After months surrounded by the sons of Ares, I see these golds less as demons than falling angels, precarious, flaring so brilliantly across the sky, before disappearing beyond the horizon. But how many more days like this can they afford? In the halls of our enemies, Roke will be reciting our names, and the names of my friends. He who kills the reaper will have glory unending, bounty and renown. Young beasts with wide shoulders and angry eyes, straight from the halls of the Corps schools, will hunt me, ready to make their name. So, too, will the old grey legionnaires hunt me, those who see my rebellion as the great threat against Mother Society, against that union which they have loved and fought for their entire lives. And Obsidian will seek me, led by masters who promised them pinks in exchange for my head. They will hunt my friends. They will say Severo's name, and Mustang's, and Ragnar's, because they do not yet know he has gone from us. They will hunt the Telemanuses, and Victra, Orion, and my howlers. But they cannot have them. Not today. Today, I take. I stand looking down at my gold allies. I am encased in militarized metal. 2.1 meters tall, 160 kilograms of death in a pulse-armor suit of blood-red. My sling-blade is coiled around my right vambrace, just above my wrist, a grav-fist on my left hand. Built for collisions in corridors today, not speed. Sephi is just as monstrous as I in her brother's armor, hate in her eyes seeing this host of enemies. My allies needed to see her, to see me. To know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Reaper is more alive than ever. Many of the Martians fell with me in the rain. Some look at me with hate, others with curiosity, and some, a very few, salute. But from most, there's a contempt that will never be washed away. That's why I brought Sephi. Absent love, fear, will do nicely in a pinch. Upon hearing news that Roke's fleet has begun its journey from Europa, I make my farewell to Romulus and his coterie of praetors, who helped devise our battle plan. Romulus's handshake is firm. Respect between us, but no love. In the hangar I say goodbye to Mustang and the Telemannuses. The floor vibrates as shuttles ferry the hundreds of Peerless back to their ships. It seems like we're always saying farewell, I say to Kavax, after he says his goodbyes to Mustang, lifting her up easy as he might a little doll, and kissing her head.
Farewell? It is not farewell.
He rumbles with a toothy grin.
Win today, and it becomes just a long hello. Much life left for the both of us, I think.
I don't know how to thank you, I say.
What for?
Kavax asks, confused as per usual. The kindness. I don't know how else to say it. For watching over my friends when I'm not even one of you.
One of us?
His ruddy face smirks.
A fool. You speak like a fool. My boy made you one of us.
He looks across the hangar where Mustang speaks with one of Lorne's daughters-in-law near a transport.
She makes you one of us.
It's all I can do to keep the tears from my eyes.
And if we damn all that, I say you're one of us. So one of us you are.
He lets Sophocles down from his shoulder perch to lope onto the floor. Circling, the fox jumps up onto my leg to dig something out of a joint in my armor. A jelly bean. Thraxa puts a finger to her lips behind her father. The big man's eyes light up.
What fresh deliciousness is this, Sophocles? Oh, your favorite kind, watermelon.
The fox returns, jumping up onto his shoulder.
See? You have his benediction as well.